Welcome to episode one of the podcast series Alternate Realities. In this podcast series, we're going to be exploring mind, body, and spirit. And we're going to show you, as we go through talking to our guests, that there's actually no definition, no distinction, and no separation, most importantly, between all three. Sometimes in life, we hear things from people that Arnie would call the naysayers. People tell us quite frequently when we talk about our hopes or our dreams that we will not be able to do it. You can't do that. We hear all these negative comments that come into our mind, and if we're not careful, they actually take up residence in our mind. Today's guest is Glenn Burton, a young man who started out life and was told that he wouldn't be able to do certain things. And he was told that more than once. Glenn is going to share his story with us today and show how by using his positivity and his mindset and by setting goals and being determined to reach those goals, how he's carved out the life that he has for himself. So we welcome Glenn today, and we're very honoured for him to share his story with us. So good afternoon, Glenn. Thank you for joining me on the podcast today. I'm really keen and very interested to hear so much about your life. It's certainly an interesting one.
Thank you, Jay. I'm really excited to be on this podcast, and I appreciate you having me on it.
So should we start for the listener, and if you could tell me a little bit about where you were born and your early background?
Well, I was born in Middlesbrough in the northeast, and my parents divorced when I was young, so I spent quite a significant part of my childhood living with my mom, my dad, my grandparents. And then, I was hanging around with the wrong crowd. I wasn't doing great at school. So at the age of 16, I decided to, become an adult as quick as I possibly could and head off to join the army. And that for me was a good out for me. I didn't want to be, getting into trouble. I wanted to learn things in life, and my dad was in the Territorial Army, so I decided to go down to the careers office, and I passed it three or four times before going in, plucking up the courage. And when I went in, I felt comfortable straight away, seeing the recruiting staff in uniform, and I signed up, and basically I just went from there.
So you're saying that you went into the careers office, and I can imagine as a teenager sort of walking past and thinking about it, that can feel a little bit what am I doing next? But can you tell me, when did you actually join the army? Sort of what was the date?
I joined the army on January 14th, 1991. And that was where I needed to be in Pirbright in Surrey to start basic training at the Guards Depot.
Okay, so you were in Pirbright, and can you now sort of go on to tell us a bit about what army life was like as a young lad of 16?
Well, it was tough, and I think any 16-year-old going into that environment, or anyone of a young age going into that environment, would struggle to adapt, and I was no different to anybody else. I'd left home, which I wasn't. It wasn't a problem for leaving home. I was excited about the challenge ahead. But, when I left Middlesbrough and I boarded that train down to King's Cross, I knew people doubted my ability to succeed. I'd heard one comment of he wouldn't last 5 minutes. And I used that to my gain. I very early on developed a strong mental attitude, that mental resilience. And I knew I'd succeed in basic training, as difficult as it would be the minute I walked through that main gate in Pirbright, because I didn't want to be looked at as a failure. Yes, I had a poor education behind me. I had no criminal record, but I didn't want to return to that way of life. So for me, the minute I walked in that gate, the only way you were getting me out of it was to carry me out.
And it's quite tough, isn't it? As a teenager, it's really quite tough when you do hear somebody sort of doubting your ability and doubting that you will make it and you'll get through that training.
Absolutely. Absolutely. For any youngster, for any young adult, hearing any type of negativity, it sets you back. And we're all different. It impacts you in different ways. But, you know, going into basic training, I had no idea what to expect other than what the recruitment staff had talked to me about. Yeah, they said it was hard, but you never really grasp how hard it is until you're immersed in it. And, you know, I struggled in areas, but then I excelled in others. And as basic training's designed, it's to take you from, you know, nothing basically into a professional trained soldier. And I was happy to learn, and I became much more mentally strong for it. And I wouldn't change any of this. If I could go back in time, I would do it all again.
And what would you say the areas, from memory, that you particularly excelled in, and which were the ones that you found difficult? Because I think that's something that youngsters would be quite interested in, you know, maybe they can relate to it.
Yeah, I mean, it came back to the education side. You know, I wasn't that educationally gifted. And when we're out in the field, I was excelling more in the field, on the ranges, the fitness element. You know, I became one of the fittest guys in the platoon. And I loved that stuff. And that's carried over to the present day. You know, we'll get to my further career in a little while, but I went on to, you know, be involved in the global security industry, and I've never been an office guy. I've been an operator. So going back to as a 16-year-old in basic training, excelling in the field, all the field craft, on the assault courses, things like that, wonderful. Loved every minute of it. But put me in a classroom learning about education, no, it wasn't for me.
So would you say then, as you're talking about that, that confidence that you didn't have, you know, when you went there and you kind of heard these voices, echoing that you wouldn't make it. Did going out into the field and actually excelling at something, was that something that was really significant in building that confidence?
Absolutely, because I just constantly kept telling myself that I had to keep pushing myself beyond my limits. And you didn't know what your limits were to a certain degree. But, you know, at the end of a day, when you're absolutely exhausted, you know you'd done your very best. And that for me was all I wanted to do. If I kept my mouth shut, if I kept putting my all in, and you'd see, you know, people drop out of runs, drop out of all sorts of different things. And, you know, although it was sad for them, because I'm sure they all had dreams to be a soldier. Yeah, sad for them. It was good for me and good for others who were sticking at it.
That's great. And I think, you know, when people go through training, I know obviously you're aware that my late husband was in the parachute regiment, and, you know, there is a huge dropout rate when you've got any kind of class of recruits, isn't there? Because it's not easy. It's not just a matter of putting on a uniform and then going out there and doing that job. You have to really go through that hard training to get there.
Absolutely. And, you know, I had nobody to really bounce any ideas off before I joined the army, before I went to basic training. Like I said, my dad was in the TA, but, you know, he hadn't gone through basic training like I'd gone through. So I didn't have friends who'd done it. It was really just me in my circle of who I knew that went off and joined the army. But, it's tough. Again, it's designed, you know, back in the 90s as well, early 90s, it was no holds barred. And I know there's been a much more softer approach taken, although it's still difficult in the present day. But back then, it was tough, real graft needed to succeed.
Yes, I can really relate to that, sort of from the stories I've heard from the guys over the years. So when you joined, when was it you finished your training? How long was it before you went on your first posting, and where was that?
I finished basic training on December 18th, 1991, and then I had a couple of weeks off for the Christmas break, so I went back home. You know, feeling good, feeling excited about the challenge ahead, but I was joining the 2nd Battalion Coldstream Guards, who were based at Chelsea Barracks. And I remember going down there, January 5th, it was, 1992, first day of joining the battalion. I'd heard all sorts of horror stories, you know, of how I was going to be treated as a new draft, so to speak. But I adapted and integrated into the battalion relatively quickly. What I didn't enjoy so much was training and learning the ceremonial side. And the Coldstream Guards, part of the household division, very ceremonial, but they've also got, you know, a strong infantry component to that. And the ceremonial side was just not for me whatsoever. I remember on my first Queen's Guard, it was at Buckingham Palace, and I got locked up for poor turnout. And I felt humiliated. You know, I was a young lad, but I think it was their way of saying, right, we're going to raise the standard, and this is what you need to be looking at. This is what you need to be looking for. You look like crap, go to jail. So that was for me was, you know, a turn off. Never liked it since.
So that kind of put you off a bit more, did it?
Oh, without a doubt. You know, yeah. Part of me was looking forward to, you know, going to Buckingham Palace and doing all that stuff. And then it started off badly by getting locked up by the adjutant. I never forget his name, Captain Tower. But
Captain Tower put you in the tower then?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. But I was very thankful, actually, when in 1993, a couple of years on from that, end of 93, the 2nd Battalion Coldstream Guards amalgamated. So we were all transferred over to the 1st Battalion, which were in Germany. And it was a mechanized unit. And I enjoyed that much more. But yeah, life in London wasn't great. You know, you'd go do Guards, Windsor Castle, Tower of London, Buckingham Palace, and then it'd be the same routine, bit of training, go out with the lads. So it wasn't for me. I wanted to be a soldier. I wanted to get out there. And look, no disrespect, a lot of good soldiers who really enjoy the ceremonial side, but it just wasn't for me.
Yeah, and that's really important, isn't it, when it comes to any career, that you're actually enjoying what you're doing.
Absolutely.
So tell me about your first sort of posting, you know, that was actually real soldiering for you then.
Yeah, so like I said, ended up in Germany with the 1st Battalion in Munster. And I wasn't a big fan initially. You know, I was immersed in this foreign environment, couldn't speak the language. The battalion were out in Bosnia at the time. So I joined the rear party, which was basically just being on guard at the barracks, doing some training, playing football, going out drinking and repeat. And that was life. And it was okay. It was enjoyable. Good bunch of lads. But then I got the opportunity to head over to Northern Ireland. And I was really looking forward to that, because that to me at the time in the early 90s was, it was danger. It was a full on operational tour. You knew it wasn't a game. So I did a lot of training in the build-up to Northern Ireland, which would be my first tour, and went away. And it was somewhat of a quiet time over there. You know, we didn't have any major incidents, but joined a good team. And I enjoyed myself, and I kind of got this bug for the operational side. And I was looking for the next opportunity to get operational again, to get on the ground. But I was going back to Germany, and I didn't see much come of that until one day, you know, I was called into the adjutant's office, and he basically presented me with an opportunity that was to change my life. I just didn't know it at the time. And that was to go out to Bosnia myself. The battalion had just come back, and I was asked to go out and work with General Sir Michael Rose. And, you know, this general I knew had a good name, fearsome reputation. And General Rose was the former commanding officer of the Special Air Service, former director of British Special Forces. And he was a man you wanted to work for. So really, I just grasped it and said, yeah, I want to go.
So when you went to work with General Rose, what year were you in by then?
1994, June 1994. From the day the adjutant asked me if I wanted to do it, I had to go back, pack up my gear. And the next day I was on a plane to Bryce Norton. I overnighted in Bryce Norton in the UK. And I remember that night, you know, I went to a local pub, had a couple of pints, and I thought about what might lie ahead. Northern Ireland was a completely different ballgame to what I was about to walk into, which was a ferocious, fearsome, brutal war, which was occurring in the Balkans. And I'd seen plenty of news stories in the time that it had been ongoing. And I was excited, but nervous. And the role I was going out to carry out was as the general's batman, which is, you know, you're handling his residence, you're managing the staff. You know, just being just being on hand for the general. But I went out there, and that role was to quickly change. And it was one that kind of led me into a new field later on in life. But the time in Bosnia, working with his Special Forces Close Protection Team, who took me under their wing, they seen talents in me as a young lad. And I was 21 years old by the time I got out of Bosnia. And they seen these talents in me that they helped manipulate for their gain, for the general's gain, for my gain. They trained me in close protection.
And I think, Glenn, you know, when I've heard people, you know, we're all familiar, all of us in the military world are familiar with the word bloater. And, you know, we hear people talking, you know, in civvy streets sometimes that, you know, are very good at telling stories of what they have and haven't done in life. And I don't think most people realise what goes with putting together a good close protection. You know, you're there and you need that training, don't you?
You know, I had no concept of it whatsoever until I arrived in Bosnia. I didn't know it existed, to be honest. But I was watching this close protection team daily. I was working with them. We were socialising. I was going out on the ground with them. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I was there as the general's Batman, but then I was his driver. And then I was part of the security team. And this was a 5-man, you know, specialist, highly trained close protection team that was led by a guy in the SAS. And he and I still speak to this day weekly. But he became my mentor. And I looked at him as a true leader, a true soldier. And I was working with a bunch of leaders, great soldiers, and also obviously a general that he just took no crap from anybody. He was exceptional in what he did. And again, I was 21 years old, being exposed to environments and situations and experiences that I really had no right being exposed to or being a part of. Because when something went wrong, something bad, we would have to deploy straight away out of the general's residence with the general. He'd be in front of the world's media. He'd be meeting world leaders. We'd be attending an incident, shocking incident, where, you know, a mortar might have just gone off in a marketplace or a mass war grave, courtesy of genocide. Again, 21 years old, you've got to have that mental strength. And if you haven't got it, you've got to find it real quick.
It's a real tough one. And I don't think people, if they've not lived through some kind of a war, you know, really actually understand some of the nastier sides of it. You know, it's great watching movies, you know, when things are going well, but, you know, you're talking about the other side of it, which is the reality, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you've basically gone from being this 16-year-old who's joined up, and in the space of 5 years, you know, you've had one opportunity after another that's led you to a completely different place.
Yeah, but I was also a bit of a pain in the backside as well with my superiors. I want to do this, I want to do that, I want to be on this operation, I want to do that operation. And in the end, it paid off because I had quite a good relationship with the adjutant, even though I was a young soldier. And I was fortunate that he thought of me when this opportunity came up. And the reason it was a member of the Coldstream Guards that was doing this with General Rose is because that was his parent regiment. You know, he'd been a member of the Coldstream Guards many years earlier and later became, you know, colonel of the regiment, so to speak, you know.
So that was a pretty tough experience for you as a very young man.
It was tough, but, we had such an amazing time. The bond, the brotherhood, the camaraderie, the trust, everything just clicked. And I was with a bunch of, you know, elite soldiers who'd been in the army 10, 12 years. And I had to adapt because if I didn't, if I wasn't going to be a fit in that team, then I'd have just been shipped back to the UK in a heartbeat. And it was the most special time in my life, but I didn't fully appreciate that until later in life, after I'd gained much more experiences in the military and private sector. But being part of this team, it may have been God's way of saying, hey, you belong in this. You're going to learn so much from this. Now put your all in and go for it.
And you certainly did, by the sounds of things, Glenn. So you're in the army for 10 years. And what made you make the decision to leave?
Well, after Bosnia, I went off and did a number of other operational tours, primarily in Northern Ireland. I did 5 in Northern Ireland in total. But Bosnia was absolutely perfect in every way, even though we've seen a lot of bad, which might sound a little bizarre to some people, I couldn't find that again. I couldn't find that small elite team of like-minded people, that brotherhood. Even though I was, you know, a senior, going on to become a senior soldier in my battalion, I had great relationships with everybody. I couldn't find that again. And I had three choices. One was to continue in a military career, just plodding along. 2 was to go for special forces selection. And 3 was to leave the military and pursue a career in close protection, because that's what had really got my attention in Bosnia. I was part of this team. I'd been trained and I enjoyed it. You know, I enjoyed looking after people and being part of this small elite team. So I went and spoke to the company commander and I just voiced my concerns with him and my aspirations. And he basically said, look, we'll send you down to the Guards Depot for 6 months as an instructor, see how you get on, see if you like that. And I went and did it. And I got to admit, it was completely different. I enjoyed parts of it. It was completely different, though, from when I started basic training, you know, 9 years earlier. But it was enjoyable to teach. It was enjoyable to take, you know, young kids like me who'd been there. But the training was a lot different than what it was when I was in. And I think I struggled a bit with that, as did other instructors. And after 6 months, I, you know, went back to the battalion and I basically put my notice in and I was out within a month and decided to pursue a career in close protection. I'd become passionate about that, but I didn't know about it other than what I'd done in Bosnia. I wanted to learn. I wanted to grow in that field and make a career of it.
So you've gone back and almost... looking at your story so far, you've gone full circle, haven't you? You started off as that nervous sort of, you know, lacking in confidence 16-year-old that was determined to make people see that you could do it, and you certainly did that. And then you've ended up back at the depot actually teaching others.
Yeah, but in between, I gained so many good skill sets, really beneficial and relevant skill sets.
For sure.
You know, it's like anything. It doesn't matter how old you are. It doesn't matter how weak you are. If you put all the effort in and build that confidence, you'll get so much reward from it. It may not happen overnight, but for me, what I learned was if you keep sticking away at it, it will come and you will grow from that. But when I moved into close protection, when I left the army, you know, moved back home to Middlesbrough, I was staying with my mom. And I didn't have any intention of staying there for long. I wanted to be out and about. You know, I'd done a good close protection course. But the same negative mindset was appearing yet again. When people, you know, learned I'd left the army, I was going into close protection. You know, he won't do close protection. He's a skinny guy. He's this, he's that. You know, that's the negative mindset. I don't know if it just applies to where I come from, but I was seeing it. I was witnessing it. But I used it again to my gain. And I stuck at it. And that's the key in any walk of life. If you stick at it and believe in it and you're passionate about it, then give it all you got. To hell with what others say.
It's that thing though, isn't it, Glenn? You know, we're both qualified coaches and it definitely is that thing whereby, you know, if we were coaching somebody else, we would always encourage them to have that goal and focus on that goal, you know, because that's the thing you're aiming for.
Absolutely. And it's very easy to be impacted by others' thoughts, negative and positive. And, you know, for me as a young boy at 16, I could have took that as, well, you know, maybe they're right. Maybe I don't have what it takes to be a professional soldier. But I completely reversed that and used it to my gain. Going into close protection, real tough industry. And at, you know, 26, 27, going into close protection. That is a relatively young age for that line of work. So I was under no illusions of how difficult it was going to be, but I decided to stick at it, study at it, train, keep my fitness, use my military skills, and get in the door. And once I was in the door, that's when I needed to make the most of it and grasp every opportunity.
So how did you go from doing that course and having all that experience to actually getting into the close protection world? How did that come about?
It was tough at first. You know, it's very rare you just leave the military, go on a close protection course and get a job. Like I say, I went back home to Middlesbrough and I was doing little jobs here and there, jobs that were not meaningful in any way. I was driving a truck now and again. I was doing a bit of bricklaying. The winter months were coming in. It was miserable. And then all of a sudden, I got an opportunity to go down London to work at a really high-end store doing security. And I did that for about 6 weeks. And then I got a phone call from a guy who'd been on my close protection course. This guy was called Bernie. He was from Birmingham. Wasn't ex-military, but he was a very, very good operator. You could see that on the training course that he was on with me. And he'd got an opportunity to work with a Middle Eastern royal family in London. And he called me up. They had a vacancy and he said, hey, you know, we're looking for another guy if you want to come and interview. So he made the connection. I went and did the interview. And then I joined this particular royal family who were in the UK for about 4 months. And I was on their residential security team. And then I'd go out with them now and again with the kids. You know, the kids were very important, obviously, to the elders. And, you know, we'd be off to Paris and we'd be in London doing all sorts of stuff. So that was really my foot in the door that I'd been looking for. And obviously working for any royal family, it's good for your CV. And I worked with them for 4 or 5 months. And then I decided to go out to America for a couple of weeks to see a friend of mine who was working with a celebrity out there on a music tour, on a world tour. So I decided to go out to America for a couple of weeks.
And so when did you arrive in America?
I arrived in Palm Springs, California on September 8th, 2001. And I spent a few days out there in Palm Springs. And then I was taking a drive to Los Angeles. And I remember I woke up about 5 o'clock in the morning and I was going to a gas station, to a petrol station, to jump on a shuttle bus. And that shuttle bus would take me from Palm Springs to Los Angeles International Airport, where I'd jump in a taxi to go and meet my friend. However, in Palm Springs, I arrived at that gas station shortly after 6 a.m. and I walked in, poured myself a coffee. I had about 30 minutes before this shuttle was going to arrive. And I looked up at the TV screen and I seen the most horrendous sight. And it was a plane crashing into the World Trade Center in New York. So the morning was September 11th, 2001, that my journey in America really began.
Wow.
That's when I was coming to Los Angeles. And, you know, I seen the first plane hit. And jumped in the car, in the shuttle. And as we pulled onto the freeway for the 2-hour drive, the next plane hit. And that's when I personally knew that America was at war. You know, America's under attack. This wasn't an accident.
No, and I think for all of us, I can remember exactly where I was when that happened. I think everybody will always remember where they were when that happened. But for you, you know, you're actually in America, you've only been there a couple of days, and this horrendous thing is just unfolding in front of your eyes.
It was very surreal being in America at that time. It was devastating, you know, devastating for all those impacted. But also for the American people as well, because, you know, as a country, they'd left themselves wide open and it came back and really hit them hard. Not just in New York, but, you know, at the Pentagon in Pennsylvania with the plane being taken down. There was a lot of brave people involved in this, in these events. Unfortunately, the bad guys won. But, you know, it certainly took the shine off my trip. I was out there for 2 weeks, met up with my friend, learned more about the close protection industry. I had no intention of staying in America, none whatsoever. It was my first trip to America. And I was just out there for a bit of a break, having been, you know, hard at it with the royal family for 4 months. But that night I arrived in, that morning I arrived in Los Angeles, met up with my friend, but that night I actually met a girl, and nice girl. We ended up hanging out during my stay, and we decided that I wasn't going to go home. So we ended up dating. I could only really stay in the US for 3 months. So I was off to Mexico. I was off to Asia doing some work down to South America. I'd be coming back, and it worked out great. And we dated for just over 3 years. And then we married in the fourth year. So that's how it panned out. But in that time as well, I deployed out to Iraq as a private contractor for a British company. I did that in 2003. And I wanted to go out there. You know, not only was the money good, but for me, it was working in a high-risk environment. It was bringing back memories of working in the military and the operational side. So I went out to Iraq for 6 months and then came back to America. A few months later, we got married.
So that was a very long two-week holiday for you.
Yeah, I remember when I left Middlesbrough, I said to my mum, see you in 2 weeks. I think it was about 2 years when I seen her next.
Well, I'm sure she was sat relieved. There waiting and relieved to see you when you did come back.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you've gone out to Iraq, and by now it's 2003. Where did your close protection career take you after that?
Well, in Iraq, I'd met up with a few guys who'd been in the Coldstream Guards, which was great. So it was good that I went into this environment, you know, knowing people when I got on the ground. So it was really great to bump into a few people there. But going back to America, you know, I got married in September 2004, and I'd done some training in the early days in America with a guy, and I'll mention his name because he's no longer with us, but Steve Hall. Steve Hall was a former British soldier, and then he went on to work with MI5 before moving out to America himself. And Steve was currently working on the Microsoft team, working with Bill Gates at the time. And it's that phone call, it's that connection, that network. Steve had called me up one day and says, hey, we're looking for a couple of guys to join our team. We're doing a selection period. Now, I was living in Los Angeles at the time. They were based up in Seattle. I spoke to my wife. She wasn't really keen on it. She didn't want to leave LA, but I thought it'd be good for us as a newly married couple. And I went ahead and did the training, did the selection. There was about five people on it. I became successful in it, and I was offered the job. And I was actually offered the job when we were on honeymoon and we were in Hawaii. And I was all excited. I was really excited. But unfortunately, my wife wasn't feeling that excitement. You know, here I was as a young lad still, given an opportunity to go work for then the richest guy in the world. It caused some friction early on, but I still thought I was doing the right thing. And so that's what we did. I moved to Seattle when we got back, and I was up there for a few months before she joined me. But that's where it really began up there. Spent about 16 months up in Seattle with Bill Gates and the leadership team of Microsoft. Really great. Big security team. A lot of travel, a lot of international travel. So I was becoming more accustomed and aware of the international market, of working international. Really enjoyed it. But then I moved back to Los Angeles after my time with Microsoft, and that's when I really stepped into the celebrity protection side. I was given an opportunity there, and yeah, it just took off. Just took off really from there. But I think working with the royal family and then certainly with Bill Gates gave me a really good platform to build on. It was up to me to build it myself. I'm not just going to be given opportunities. I've got to work for them.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, you've had those opportunities, and you've then got a really fabulous CV together by doing that, haven't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I've come across a lot of people in the last 20 years, especially living in America. They get opportunities, but they quickly fall into a comfort zone, and then they worry that the job's at stake, or, you know, you've got to really maximize everything. Again, you've got to be passionate about what you do. And if you're not passionate about it, you shouldn't be doing it.
So what was it like going from working, you know, for a royal family, then Bill Gates, to going into the world of celebrity?
Totally different. Very different. I've been very fortunate in the sense that, you know, I've worked with some big names, but it all had to start somewhere. And I'd been networking with a couple of companies in Los Angeles, one of which was run by a couple of Israeli guys. And I grew to like these guys, you know, a lot, and they liked me. The scene that I had some good experience, but more importantly, the scene I had good potential. And they had some big clients from a celebrity standpoint. And obviously I was back in LA. I was able to work now legally because I was married and a resident. And they had an opportunity coming up, which was just for a media appearance for one of their main clients. And they threw me on it. They thought, you know, let's give them a shot. And I went and did this media appearance with this particular individual. Well, I mean, it was Will Smith. So as big as you can get in the entertainment world. But that one opportunity with Will, I ended up, you know, spending a number of years with him, traveling the world with him. And great guy, smart guy, polite, good family. You know, I think a lot of people, unfortunately, have a perception of celebrities, which, you know, is understandable to a certain degree, especially now with social media. But there's no airs and graces with someone like Will Smith. You learn a lot from him. You learn a lot from him, but there's also a very serious part. You don't get starstruck. It's very easy to get starstruck. It doesn't matter who you are, security, hired help in any capacity. It doesn't matter. You're going to get starstruck. But for me, I needed to get that out of the way after the first 24 hours.
Well, it's important, isn't it, when you're taking care of somebody that, you know, that your mind is actually focused.
Absolutely, because the other thing as well is they're surrounded by all these starstruck people, strangers, media, everything. They're surrounded by these people day in, day out. They can't even go to, you know, the supermarket without being inundated for a picture or something. So I've got a good understanding of their mindsets, what they like, what they don't like, what they're comfortable with. And everyone's different, but I was able to learn with a number of different clients the areas that they like, what they don't like, what they're looking for, what they're not looking for. Do they want the media attention? Do they not? And that might vary day to day, mood to mood.
I think that's the thing that a lot of people don't realise with celebrities, isn't it? Is that actually some of them kind of caught the press and they caught that attention, and others actually just want to, you know, do the job and go from here to there and be a lot more sort of quieter about it.
Yeah, but I think also that the evolution of social media has just made things a lot worse. Yeah, people want to use that, you know, to their personal gain and grow a fan base and gain more popularity. I mean, I use the Kardashians as an example. I'm still not so sure what they're famous for, but, you know, they've got this social media following that is intense. It's huge. I mean, yeah. I think Kim has, you know, 60, 70, 80 million followers. But I think a lot of people can get mixed messages from things like that. You know, there's a lot of immaterial things. They may be sponsoring something. There may be something on show. But back in, you know, early 2000, mid 2000, when I was working with, you know, some really big names, we didn't have the social media side as much as what we have now. There are much more tools that people can use. And, you know, to a certain degree, if you can use that, that benefits you, great. But you've got to do it the right way and got to send out the right message, because there's a lot of kids following these people. And I think sometimes that's forgotten.
Totally, totally agree, Glenn. And I was actually talking to somebody the other day about this. We were talking about what we've been talking about during this interview, you know, about sort of building confidence, building self-esteem, you know, in youngsters. And I remember saying to this friend of mine, you know, just that title of that TV program to me is a little bit worrying, keeping up with the Kardashians. So, you know, there's a lot about the celebrity life now that kind of gives this impression through social media to youngsters that they do have to keep up with something.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And, you know, I was reading a newspaper yesterday, British newspaper online, and it shocked me how many people, you know, B-list type celebrities. But I mean, when we talk about different celebrities, you know, the likes of, you know, Will Smith and musicians such as Madonna and U2, people like that. They're to me A-list.
Yeah.
Then you've got the others who, some others who, you know, would be classed as B-list. They want to fast track themselves to A-list as soon as they possibly can and however they possibly can. But, you know, you've got to, you've got to make sure that you're a responsible human being in all this as well. And I've seen some real horror stories with, and heard horror stories with some people who are just trying to be famous. And it's, you know, to a certain degree, it's not acceptable. It's not appropriate.
No, I agree, Glenn. And I think as we go forward and social media gets bigger and bigger and bigger, hopefully it will do a little bit of a turnaround, and there will be, because as a celebrity, I completely agree with you. There is a responsibility to people that do follow you and people that look up to you. And if you're not living your life in any kind of, you know, decent way with integrity, then you're giving a very, very negative message out to young people who, you know, maybe don't get that. Maybe they don't have the family support. Maybe they don't have the mentors, you know, to be able to lead them in the right direction.
Exactly. But I'm, you know, I'm very fortunate in the sense that I knew what I was looking for when I entered the entertainment field. And it wasn't to work with someone who was on the rise, who was trying to get to that A-list. I was very fortunate in the sense that I work with A-list, very well-known people who don't have to, you know, put themselves out there or call the media. You know, there's some people out there who they'll have their agent call the media or call the paparazzi and say, hey, such and such is leaving.
Yeah.
In an hour, if you want to get her or get him. And then that picture of her leaving a restaurant or whatever it might be is suddenly on People magazine, and there's the exposure they've got for the day. And that works for some people. But for me, I just don't like that whole approach. And it's one of the reasons that, you know, I ended up leaving the entertainment industry later. You know, I worked in it for about 8 years, but, you know, I worked with some really good people, really nice people.
And you traveled a lot by working with those people.
I traveled a lot, and in that 8 year period, you know, I only say this because I'm not working with them anymore, because I did move into the high net worth family side. But, you know, Will Smith, Halle Berry for a number of years, Madonna for a number of years. I worked with Sacha Baron Cohen on Borat and Bruno, which was extremely challenging, the two movies he did. And I have to say, you know, Will Smith, as nice of a guy as he is, Sacha Baron Cohen is probably the smartest person I have ever worked with. He's a nice guy. His wife, Isla Fisher, lovely lady. But Sacha is a very, very smart man.
It's great that you've had that really positive experience in that field. So you went then, obviously you're saying now, you kind of moved away from the celebrity world. You've done 8 years in that. And then you moved into what next?
What was important for me when I ventured into close protection was finding my niche. And I knew the different areas of close protection, and that was high risk work, celebrity work, corporate work, and working with families. So I'd done the high risk stuff. I'd done the royal family stuff. I went off to do the celebrity stuff. And now it was time to get an opportunity to go and work with a high net worth family. And I'd also done some corporate work with Bill Gates. So working with this family, I was asked to move out to New York. So my wife and I moved out, and I worked with this family, and I felt that was my niche. I'd found it. Although I was comfortable in the other areas, I wanted to make sure that I'd covered all areas of work, of opportunity. And for me, finding that, working with a high net worth family, and we're talking, you know, 500 million, a billion plus of their worth, was much more rewarding in the sense that I felt that the need for security, for close protection, was greater than the celebrity side, obviously. Corporate side, you know, you're not just dealing with physical harm, but you're also dealing with reputational harm. So you're protecting people from reputational damage as well. But working with the family side, I felt that was a really good fit. So I decided to move forward and, you know, work that family and corporate angle as opposed to the celebrity side. And, you know, I've thoroughly enjoyed living in LA, thoroughly enjoyed working with different celebrities. But, you know, walking a red carpet or going to a specific event or being on a movie and being on seven movies, that's all great. But it wasn't my niche. I wasn't passionate about it. I'm not starstruck. But the family side for me was much more meaningful, along with the corporate executives. And that's what I've carried on doing and, you know, built a really good name in that area.
So it's a big difference, not just in the people that you're working with. It's, you know, you're changing geographically from LA to New York, which are very, very different places.
Yeah. Yeah. But you're also changing your method of operating as well, because, you know, working with the entertainment side, you're a lot more high profile.
Yeah.
You know, you tend to get recognized that just a little bit more on the street. Paparazzi recognize you. Whereas working with corporate executives and high net worth families, you've got to adopt a more low profile mindset. And there are some families, especially in America, who are quite well known, but that operation needs to be run accordingly to suit that particular client. But for me, I've primarily worked as a solo operator, working with families, blending in rather than standing out. And that's worked for me and those that have relied on me. But traveling the world with the people that I have has been an amazing experience. And, you know, my life was to change yet again in 2008 when a vacation and a holiday and family from America were in India. And I received a phone call of a major terror attack that was taking place. And I ran back in my house, put the TV on, watched this unfold. And it was a particular family who I did not know at the time. This family had been put in touch with me. They were in immediate danger and they needed help. And they were caught up in the Mumbai terror attacks in 2008. And I had them on the phone. But that day, things changed. It was like very much like 9/11 for me. The day changed in the sense that I always needed and wanted to be accessible. Not just to people who know me, not just to current clients, but also others whom, you know, I may not know, but who may have my number in case a problem occurs. And this terror attack was not a pleasant situation at all, as is any, but there were a lot of people killed. Seven different attacks in Mumbai. And it was my responsibility to reassure that family, give them advice. But listening to their two kids in this hotel room while terrorists are outside that hotel room and you know, firing guns, firing rounds off in corridors, these two kids were petrified. The mom and dad were petrified. So you got to have that reassuring mindset. But I tell you, there's no worse feeling than being 7,000 miles away to a family in distress who don't have a clue what to do, who have no plan B, who have no contingencies in place. Because at that time, back in 2008, you know, there wasn't the threat of ISIS and Al-Qaeda and all these major issues that we've seen in recent times.
That was yet to come.
So people going on holiday, they're just focused on their holiday. And over the 3 day, the attack was 3 days, but it was my job to put a team together to go in and rescue that family. And that's what we did. And we got this family out, which was very good for me, but it was great for them. But the lasting impact, I know, will always be with them.
And tough for you as well, Glenn, because in a situation like that, you know, you've got that, everybody's got that feeling for the family or anybody that's in distress or who's in that kind of difficult situation. But you have to keep your cool and you have to get a job done.
You have to. And, you know, I can't underestimate the amount of stress and pressure that is put into a situation like that. When this particular family are begging you for help, doesn't matter about what they're going to pay, but they're begging you for help. What do we do? There was loads of different elements to this. They had to keep their phone charged, but the power was cut. You know, what if we lost communication? Then what? I had to get as much information, relevant information, that was straight to the point to that family. You know, blockade your room. Don't make noise. Turn off light. Put your phone on silent. Don't alert these terrorists in that corridor. And 36 people died in that hotel that family were in. So, you know, saddening for them Absolutely. Saddening for their families, but this particular family had a resource and they were able to call on that resource. It's a good job I was able to answer the phone. What if I didn't answer the phone? What was their plan B? There's a lot of things that we all need to look at when we're traveling in this day and age. It does not matter about our net worth. We could be worth £100. We could be worth £1 billion. Having that knowledge and mindset of the area you're going into is absolutely essential. Because if something does go wrong, whether it's a natural disaster or a security incident or a medical related problem, then at least you've got the knowledge that you can count on.
I absolutely agree with that. And I think when it comes to just your average bog standard traveler, you know, who's going on holiday places, you know, a friend of mine worked for many, many years in the tourist business for a tour operator, and the amount of people that ended up in the clinic because they got sick when they were away and didn't have medical insurance was quite scary.
I've heard it all, honestly. I've given lectures on this stuff about travel security, about awareness, cultural understandings, and it's bizarre and alarming how many people go into foreign environments and know nothing about that environment. To a certain degree, it's okay not knowing the language, but at least learn some words. Know where the British consulate is. If you have a problem, you're going to be scrambling at the last minute and you might not have time to do that. So just be very smart. And something that's very important, leave a copy of your itinerary or rough itinerary and a copy of your passport with someone at home, because you might just need to rely on them having them.
That's great advice, Glenn. It really is. So you travel to a lot of countries in your career.
I've been to 90 countries, many of those multiple times, many times. I've been to China 30 times. A lot of good experiences. I've seen a lot of bad and been immersed in environments that are just not pleasant at all, parts of Africa. I've been in really bad rundown orphanages in Eastern Russia and seen some horrific sights. So you've got to balance it out. You know, it's not all, you know, five-star luxury working with the rich and famous. We do get to go to places that aren't as pleasant, but it's those experiences that are more memorable for me. You know, It's okay thinking about the time I stayed at the Burj Al Arab in Dubai, the only 7-star hotel in the world. But what's more meaningful is being around people and environments where you're helping, you're giving back, or you're patting someone on a shoulder that's not used to seeing, you know, a vehicle, let alone this particular white person coming in to their community or to their tribe. But, you know, my travel has been extensive, very enjoyable. In the main, I wouldn't change anything. I met a lot of good people along the way from all different walks of life, whether it's, you know, in India or China or Vietnam. There's a lot of good people out there. There's a lot of not so good too, but it's important to really acknowledge the good, because in this day and age especially, that's important.
I think we're learning that. I think with the whole COVID situation this year, you know, we're actually starting to change sociologically. It's all got sort of very different. And you know, as we've been talking about the celebrity world and people kind of living almost like a selfish lifestyle. And that's turning now. You know, you can see it starting to turn towards a little bit more about community, which... So some of the countries that you have traveled to, especially remote areas, you know, you rely on community, don't you?
You do. And I've got to be honest, in the early days of me traveling the world, I was, you know, I was stereotyping people wrongly, but young and naive and getting the opportunity to travel in the world and, you know, going into a place like India, I had one mindset. But I got to tell you, when you're around these people and you see their worth, relevant of the shoes they're wearing or the bag they're carrying, these people just want to help. And they're no different from you or I. And I've learned that greatly. And I've grown to appreciate not just the opportunities, because they're not as important, but the chance to interact with, whether it's a driver who may be picking me up or driving my particular principal, or if it's someone in a hotel. In the main, they will go above and beyond to help you, but you know, don't treat them like they're nothing, because they don't deserve that.
No, I remember many years ago, you know, one of my jobs over the years has been to, I used to work on building sites selling property, and I always had this one way of working, and I treated the security guard with the same respect as I treated the MD. In fact, sometimes I treated him with a lot more respect than the MD, depending on how the MD behaved. But you know where I'm coming from on that one. So,
yeah, just add you as well, you know, working with corporate executives and high net worth families especially, I've learned a great deal as well. I've not just been there shadowing them and keeping them safe, but I've been able to listen and watch and observe in the way they interact with people around the world, whether it's a business partner or a business customer, or if it's friends or vendors. And I've learned a great deal from everyone I've worked with, and I've always taken a little piece that's helped to mold myself into the best person that I could possibly be. Am I perfect? No, but I strive every day to deliver excellence in my job and to be a good person. And that's important to me, because I have a daughter. I want her to see that, you know, she's got a dad who she can look at as a really good role model, who's got all these experiences that are very dynamic.
That's great, Glenn. It really is. So tell us on that note, what are you doing now? What's going on in your world of work these days?
Well, I'm still heavily involved in the global security industry. I run the executive protection for a very big company out of California. So up until COVID hit, I was traveling extensively. Really, really great job, great people. And I've been with them for the past 4.5 years. And it's just a good company, nice corporate environment, big responsibility. And, the travel is amazing. I mean, we go to a lot of government-type meetings and around the world. You know, my last trip actually was in Paris, and the meeting was with President Macron. And so I get a lot of really good opportunities interacting with people, different security agencies, different police units. And it's great. But in sync with that, I am doing coaching and mentoring. Like you, I'm a certified coach, and I'm also a mentor. So, you know, I bring people under my wing who want to grow as an individual, and I coach them along the way to be the best version of themselves, overcoming adversity, gaining that mental resilience, similar to the journey I've taken as a 16-year-old, you know, overcoming that doubt, gaining that strong mindset, and grown to be the best that they can be. And my motto of always moving forward in everything that I do is able to be carried over by them when they come into my program. So I enjoy doing that as well, and I take a lot from it.
And that's the great part of coaching, isn't it? When you can see somebody actually achieve what they want to achieve and become the best that they can be, but also to become their authentic self, because we are all different.
I come across a number of different people, male and female, young and, you know, somewhat middle-aged. And each of them have a story, each of them have a journey. And it's no matter what we've done in the past, what are we going to do in the future? How can we strive to achieve those goals? There's a person that I'm working with right now who is mid-20s, male, and he ventured into a line of work that he never really felt he fitted. He didn't really feel comfortable, but now he's pursuing a new career. And it's really exciting to see the growth, see the change in attitude, see that excitement showing through. Because that person who came into me on day one is now a completely different person. And that's not because I'm a specialist in my craft as a coach, but it's bringing my international experiences from around the world and guiding him to becoming that person. And it's really pleasing to see. And I know you've had people like that yourself, but you know, if you're struggling in life, or if you need direction, or if you need that guidance, I would certainly look towards having someone who you can, you know, grow with.
Yeah, it's important. I think that, you know, it's important to say as well that that is the biggest difference between dealing, you know, the whole idea of coaching is to actually be dealing with direction and, you know, exactly what you're talking about, somebody who may be in a job that they're not happy in and they want to change that. And, you know, there's all those aspects to life. Whereas therapy in inverted commas, is much more about dealing with the emotional side of life, and perhaps past trauma. And they're two very different ways of working, aren't they? And I think coaching is becoming more popular these days because people are starting to realize, and this situation worldwide right now is putting us there, isn't it? You know, you might be losing a job that you may not have liked doing anyway. So it's a perfect time to start looking at something new.
You know, I was thinking about this last night, funnily enough. I was walking my dog and I was thinking about now is a really great time to make those adjustments in your life, recalibrate your mindset. And, you know, if you weren't happy pre-COVID about something, now you've got an opportunity to change certain things, go in a new direction when the time is right to do that. But use this time now to learn new skills. You know, if you always want to learn a language, go learn a language. If you want to do an online course, go do it. If you want to find a coach, go find a coach. But there is a massive separation between a coach and a therapist. And I think in the past number of years, that's becoming more prominent, and especially with the growth of post-traumatic stress and, you know, personal issues, people are speaking out more now when they're needing that resource. But from a coaching perspective, that's always been there. That's, people have always relied on mentors and coaches. I think it's great for both sides. Gives people like me and you, Jay, an opportunity to grow our skill sets and ply our trade as a coach and mentor, but it also gives others an avenue to grow as an individual.
Absolutely. And I can't remember whose quote it is off the top of my head, but I remember seeing it recently, you know, that quote where sort of something like most men die at the age of 25, but they're not buried until they're 75. You know, and there's been historically a lot of people out there living a life that they're not happy living. And sometimes it does take a coach or a mentor or somebody outside of you to just give you that help, you know, to be that guide to make you sort of look at what direction you do want to go in and have the courage and have that support to do it and make those changes.
Yeah, and one of the benefits of having that person in your life is that they're offering an unobjective approach to what you could do. They're not a friend, they're not family, they don't know you, they don't know your history. Yeah, they'll have little bits of information, but they will be providing information and, you know, maybe saying something like, well, have you thought about looking at it from this angle? Or have you thought about taking this approach? Whereas a friend or family member might not offer that. Because to a certain degree, they may be selfish in their advice to that particular person. They, you know, for example, you know, young Johnny might want to go and join the military. But his mom says, well, actually, no, I think you'll really excel in as a teacher. That mom might be saying that because she doesn't want young Johnny to put himself in harm's way or leave home. So you should not let anyone or anything impact you and your goals, but it's good to have that resource to rely on who can offer you that different perspective.
Absolutely. Now, let me take that opportunity with you talking about Johnny's mum not wanting him to go into harm's way. That's actually the title of your book, isn't it? In Harm's Way.
Yeah, In Harm's Way, Always Moving Forward. Published the book last year in the UK, and it's gained a lot of good feedback, but you know, despite all the people I've worked with, all the international travel, all the cool things, it's not focused on that. My goal was to never write a tell-all. It never would be. You know, I respect the people I've worked with far too much to ever do that. But I wanted to give back to people who didn't know about my journey. And that includes family as well, because, you know, I'm not over there. But there are parts of the book that my family didn't even know I was involved in, you know, certain things within the military or within the private sector. But I used that leadership development, the skills I've learned over the years, the different people I've worked with, what I've taken from them all, to put it into this book. And the feedback has been good. I've enjoyed writing it, but I was glad it was over with, because then I can just sit back and focus more now on the service delivery of the coaching and mentoring. But the people that have read the book, I've had a number of emails, a number of messages from people who've read the book and given me good praise for it. So, yeah, I'm glad it's done.
And where can people, if they're interested, actually get your book from?
From my website, glenburton.com. It's on my website. It's available for hard copy, and there's a downloadable version. So, I'd appreciate the support if anyone's interested in reading about my journey. It does take you through, you know, the military side, what it was like leaving home, that negative feeling that I had behind me that encouraged me, that motivated me. And for me, you know, I focused on three key things that have helped me in my career that I bring to my coaching, and that's performance, motivation, and mindset. And if I'm performing at the highest level and I'm motivated and I've got the right mindset, then I can achieve anything I want to. And, you know, I'm very happy with the journey I've taken. There's been bumps, absolutely, but it's how we deal with life and things when we cross those bumps that are important.
That's absolutely so correct. It's like you have to have all those parts of the equation, don't you, to put the whole thing together to be able to always move forward. And in terms of this podcast, you know, it is all about mind, body, and spirit. So that's my three, you know, that I always say that your mindset is very important. The mind and what we think, our perception, the name of it's alternate realities, because we all have different perceptions of different situations, let's face it. And mind, body, and spirit can't be separated. So you've got to put all those things together to be able to achieve those goals, haven't you?
Absolutely. And, you know, coming from quite a strong military background and working in the private security industry, I've lost friends. You know, I've lost quite a few people who are not here today, but I know if they were, they would have the same mindset as me. So I want to make the most of every single opportunity. I'm very thankful to be here. But life passes quickly. And, you know, for the past 6 months, we've been dealing with a pandemic that none of us are used to. Like I said earlier, Jay, if we use this time to maximize our potential, to step out of our comfort zone and go chase those opportunities when we're ready to do that, when we feel comfortable and confident, then you never know what you can achieve, but make the most of every opportunity. And that's what I've done. And, you know, it's not from a monetary gain standpoint. I do okay, but it's what's more important to me is having that mental strength, that complete peace of mind to say, I've had a good life, a good journey, and it's all been through hard work and dedication. Because it is really true, if you put that in, you've got a hell of a lot to gain from life.
Absolutely. And this is, as we've said, a perfect time to be doing that. So if people want to contact you with regards to coaching, again, is that through your website? How do you coach people, especially with the pandemic at the moment? Are you doing online?
Yeah, I'm doing it online. So at glenburton.com, I do online programs. You know, it could be a one-off coaching session to see how you feel, to see how we engage. I don't just like to take on anybody. I want to work with someone who's got the potential and who has the goals to change their life around. Now, there's no miracles involved here. Again, it's just bringing my international experiences from around the world and bringing them into that particular individual. Each coaching session is tailored to that person. I don't just pull it off the shelf and deliver a product and take people's money, but we do Zoom one-to-one calls. I'm working with one or two companies right now on group coaching session, but it's all about team integration, about leadership. And it's really working well, because in this day and age, especially for companies, they want to have that team collaboration, and they're all looking for different avenues to do that. But what's important to me, what gives me full satisfaction, is bringing an individual who is in this point of life where they're not too happy. They want to change certain things. Doesn't mean moving to a foreign country. Just means they want to get that peace of mind that they've not been able to find. They might be going to work at 8 o'clock every morning. It's routine. It's a comfort zone. It's a paycheck. But they don't have the fulfillment. They want to have the passion. So let's get them there.
That's great. And certainly it sounds like not only do you have that, all of that experience that gives you the ability to work with those leadership skills and the teamwork and all of that, but it, you know, it's great to hear you have that integrity and say you don't just want to work with anybody, because let's face it, there's plenty of people out there, whether, you know, whatever walk of life they're in, which would be quite happy to just sort of work with anybody and not be so concerned about getting the results. And that's what coaching is all about, isn't it?
It is, but you've got to make a difference in people's lives. And that to me starts with making sure that they've got the comfort level to be able to speak freely to you. And it's not about the paycheck. And you know, my coaching sessions are 90 minutes, but sometimes I run over. But I'm not saying, oh, by the way, we're 10 minutes over and that's an additional X amount of pounds. That's not what I'm about. Some people will do that. But, you know, it's up to the individual. They've got to do the research, go find a good coach, you know, look to yourself, look at your website, look at mine. Great. But I'm more than happy to speak to people to advise them of what they should be looking for. I'm not a salesman. I've never been a good salesman, but I'm all about delivering excellence to make people the best they can be. And that's important.
Well, I wish you all the best with that, Glenn. You certainly had a very, very interesting life. I thank you very much for being with us today. It's been great speaking to you. I'm sure this is not the end of maybe changes in your life.
I don't think so. I'm excited about the future. You know, as a 46-year-old man, I've done a lot, but it's nothing compared to what I feel as if I'm going to achieve moving forward. And I really appreciate you having me on your podcast, Jay. I wish you all the best.
That concludes episode 1 of Alternate Realities podcast series exploring mind, body and spirit with our special guest today, Glenn Burton. I'm sure you will have found Glenn's story to be very inspirational. He certainly has given me a lot to think about, and I hope he's given you, the listener, something to think about. And also to take something very positive away and maybe set yourself a goal for this year. Or as it's getting to the end of the year now, maybe for next year. 2021, let's hope, is going to be a much better year than this year. Episode 2 will be online shortly. And I look forward to introducing another interesting guest with a fascinating life story to you very, very soon. Thanks for listening.